Greetings, my friends, and welcome to The Paula Gordon Show, conversations with people at the leading edge. I'm Paula. Western civilization has been dominated by the scientific worldview for 350 years. Our guest, Stuart Kaufman, is a world-famous scientist challenging the views ushered in by Galileo. Dr. Kaufman is a theoretical biologist smitten with life and concerned for our planet. The questions he's asking may well open the way for a new science building on the successes of the old one. And Dr. Kaufman hopes for even more. In his newest book, Reinventing the Sacred, Stuart Kaufman proposes to unite science, reason, and religion. He suggests that a good beginning is to expand traditional ideas of God to include all the creativity in the universe. He uses the word God to mean life is sacred, and he says people are a lot more than just reasoning machines. The result?
If God is the creativity in the universe, we too are God. So I think that then leads us to the planet as sacred. Therefore, in stewardship for the planet, I think it leads us to concern about global warming, sustaining our one ball in space of a home, because it's sacred, because it's the home of life, and life is sacred. And then I think there's a huge piece more. I think we have to rediscover our entire integrated humanity. This is the consequence of realizing that reason is an insufficient guide to live our life. Therefore, we have to integrate emotions, intuitions. I don't know how to do this.
Stuart Kaufman is a theoretical biologist and complexity scientist who welcomes both other scientists and general audiences as he challenges today's scientific orthodoxy. Dr. Kaufman was an early MacArthur Fellow. He's on the external faculty at the Santa Fe Institute, and he's founding director of the Institute for Biocomplexity and Informatics at the University of Calgary. He lectures worldwide. In addition to Reinventing the Sacred, Dr. Kaufman's books include At Home in the Universe and Investigations. Bill Russell and I are so intrigued by Dr. Kaufman's ideas that this program is a finale of many hours of conversation available elsewhere. Part of the great legacy of traditional science is the benefit of clarity. So we began this conversation with definitions.
Stuart Kaufman, I love the game of what would you take with you onto a desert island? And there are lots of different answers. One that I particularly like for myself is I would take a dictionary. Mm-hmm. Because it is such a great springboard mm-hmm. for all kinds of things. And that said, there are so many words I don't know, or words I think I know that I could know better, or words I think I know that I don't know. Let's go through some of the lexicon, if you will, some of the definitions of these many beautiful, sometimes mysterious words that we've been using in the course of our conversations. And I think I want to start, now all of these are definitional, these are short. Remember, dictionary, short. What would you
English
say?
English dictionary.
Well, not I was going
not scientific.
Yes, dictionary. And I was going to say, and of course that yeah. that's not even thinking about the science part. What would you say, just for grounding? What's Darwinism?
I knew you were going to say Darwinism. the essence of Darwinism is that it starts after life has started. It's about the evolution of life once started. And there's three cores to it. Descent.
From a common ancestor?
No, a descent from one generation to the next. With heritable variation.
So you can inherit whatever changes there are.
Yeah, so it's going to be able to be passed along. In an environment having the property that there's something selective about the environment. It could be, for example, in the case of Malthus, that you run out of food, and so you're competing for food, or whatever it is that you're competing for, or collaborating and cooperating with. There needs to be some kind of selective environment. And because of that environment, there may be differential propagation of the offspring with the heritable variation, and that gives rise to evolutionary changes. That's the core of it.
I would like to go the next step. I'm not sure this is where Paul is headed. I'm curious how you would articulate the Kaufman extension of Darwin.
Ah.
You're standing on the shoulders of a giant.
But doesn't mean that I'm one myself.
But you have taken the basic ideas and other ideas in science, and a lot of what you've done does apply directly.
And you've done what science does. You do a yes and or
yes and.
And of course, science is never fixed.
Science is never fixed.
Or finished.
So a lovely way to start this is with a quote from one of the Huxleys. Well, there's two quotes. One of them said, "What a clever idea, how stupid of me not to have thought of it." And the other one, which is true, but the other one is, and I don't know which Huxley said it, the curious thing about the theory of evolution is everyone thinks he understands it. This is before he, she became obligatory. And it's true. So the more I have thought about evolution...
What's true?
That's a curious thing about the theory of evolution is that you think you understand it because it's so easy to grasp Darwin's central idea of descent with modification because of heritable variations in a selective environment. That's it. I mean, you understand it. The more you think about it, or the more I've thought about it, and I should make it clear that I'm not an evolutionary biologist. I've done evolutionary biology, but I wasn't trained as an evolutionary biologist. I've worked in the area. The more mysterious it gets to me. So one addendum that I have tried to make in what I am fond of calling my mutterings at Darwin is that self-organization is real, and that in place of the view that Darwin didn't state, but that other biologists have come to hold, the view that the only source of order in biology is natural selection and otherwise historical accident and contingency that becomes frozen in, I have argued for years that self-organization plays a role in evolution as well. That's contentious. I've given clear examples of self-organization.
Let me put it this way. What is self-organization before you go forward? Self-organization is...
That's tough. Okay, you'd think that one could simply say what self-organization is. I've written 3 books on it, and I carefully never define it on purpose. What I do is I give examples and hope that you will pick up some intuitive notion of what self-organization is. I've seen people try to define it, and I've never seen a definition that I thought was adequate. But an example is, so we can point to it because we've talked about it. I talked about my Boolean net models, or now Stefan Turner's models of linear differential equations that spontaneously have an ordered regime, a chaotic regime in this critical phase transition. I think that's self-organization. It's an emergent property of some vast class of systems that they have this interesting dynamical property that life could have made use of. So there you feel it, right in that sentence. A vast class of systems have the self-organized property that they are either ordered or critical, not chaotic, and life could have made use of it. What does it mean, could have made use of it? It could have been selected, or it could be there anyway because of the way, for example, genetic nets just get themselves wired together and get built, and so it might be the case that it's hard for selection to avoid it. And that says that the way self-organization mingles with natural selection is entirely unclear. We don't know. I mean, maybe one comes before the other in either order, or maybe they're working together all the time. We don't understand it.
Is it testable?
Sure.
Is it experimentally demonstrable?
Which came first? Or that there is self-organization?
Yes.
Both. So we have just... in the last year begun to gather data that cells are really dynamically critical. I mentioned the size distribution of avalanches following extinction events and this stuff showing that cells are critical because neighboring states are on parallel trajectories. Okay, so it's testable, for example, whether cells are critical. Then the question is that due to selection, or is it so generic in some class of networks, which it's not in Boolean networks, but maybe in Stefan Turner's linear differential equations and some class of wire dynamical ordinary differential equation systems, where there's a volume that's critical rather than a thin line. Maybe it's just generic. I don't know how to test that now, okay? And our problem is we've got 3.8 billion years of evolution. And let's suppose that Stefan's right. How would we do an experiment that would say, discriminate the following? It's so robustly present, this property, in a class of networks, that selection can't avoid it, versus selection kind of had to tinker with it and refine it. That's the question. Now, I don't know how to do that now, but is it ultimately testable? I bet it is. I just don't know how to do it now.
What is life?
Well, the first thing to be said is that anybody who attempts to define life and then walk out in public with other biologists has a reasonable chance of losing it. But I'm gonna hazard a guess. I don't think molecular reproduction by itself does it, of the kind that Reza Gadiri and Gunter von Kitarowski have achieved.
Which is a phenomenal achievement.
Which is a phenomenal achievement. And it's a sine qua non for life. Okay. I think when we talked in our discussion about propagating organization and work cycles, coupled with molecular reproduction and encapsulation, maybe, in a non-equilibrium thermodynamic system, I think that may be the definition of life. And if so, by the way, agency comes with life, not molecular reproduction.
What is agency?
So there's human agency, and we all know what it is. It's acting for reasons, purposes, and motives with the naive psychology that sometimes, you may not have heard this, is called armchair psychology. It says sometimes people act for the reasons and purposes that they say they're acting for. And that's being an agent. It's not being an unconscious agent. It's what you could be held responsible for in court. That's human agency. The question is whether or not we can extend that notion of agency beyond humans. Was my dog Windsor an agent? Well, I'm persuaded he was. And if you've ever lived with an animal, you know, a mammal, you would be convinced of it too. Probably if we lived with crocodiles, we'd be convinced of it too. I'm convinced that a bacterium swimming up a glucose gradient is an agent. Are we stretching it? Sure. I don't want to attribute consciousness to the bacterium, but I don't want to not either. I don't know. So that means that we're going to be, in all cases in the following situation, we're going to be able to give, we hope, some kind of causal or quantum mechanical account of, or whatever, of what's going on in the organism when it's being an agent. Agentness isn't some mystical stuff.
It isn't.
Being an agent, I don't think, requires us to invoke an immaterial soul or something else that sort of invests you like a purple fog, and then you're an agent. So that means, in the case of the bacterium, leaving out quantum mechanics, there's a perfectly good classical account of what's going on in the bacterium when it swims up the glucose gradient. Maybe part of it's quantum mechanical, I don't know. If I'm right that maybe, consciousness is partially quantum mechanical, as we discussed yesterday, maybe our being agents involve quantum mechanical phenomena. But it would still have an explanation that is totally natural. Okay. I want to be careful in saying that because there are other views of emergence than the one that I gave. And we might want to come back to that. So an agent is, by definition, an entity that can act on its own behalf in an environment. That's what we mean by an agent. So that's already a teleological language, and we've got to be careful. I've imported teleological language to a minimal agent, a minimal molecular autonomous agent, my self-reproducing system doing a thermodynamic work cycle, therefore alive. I've imported it by definition. I've said, that thing is an agent, and then I turn around and say, isn't that neat? It's an agent, and it has meanings and values and purposes and whatever. So it's circular. But lots of things in science are circular. There are people like Poincaré who held that Newton's laws are circular. Lots of physicists disagree, but Poincaré wasn't a stupid man. Just to pause over this for a moment. Force is equal to mass times acceleration. Poincaré's point is that force and mass reciprocally define one another. We can measure acceleration, but the argument is that we can't independently measure force and mass. Now, there's lots of physicists who disagree, but Poincaré held that view.
What is work?
Okay, that's a very vexed concept. So it has a clear definition in Newtonian mechanics. Work in Newtonian mechanics is force acting through a distance. So remember, force is equal to mass times acceleration. So to see force, you got to be accelerating some mass. So I'm using a hockey stick to accelerate a hockey puck through some distance, and I've done work on it. Then we get to Atkins saying work is a thing. It's the constrained release of energy into a few degrees of freedom, and we talked about the cylinder and the piston. Both, I think, are right, and I think that there's something deeper going on. If you think of a random gas in random motion...
Is this going to be a definition?
Yeah. I'm going to propose one, or part of one. If you think of a gas in random motion, that's just heat. If it's not random motion, something is constraining it in some way. Let me call those constraints information for the moment. And the resulting correlated motion of the particles is work. And I think it may be measurable by measures of correlation, like something called mutual information. So there may be a direct relationship between mutual information among the motions of particles and work.
And the information you're talking about is not Shannon's information.
So what is information?
Well, in fact, what you're backing into doing that is what Paul is about to ask. So what's information?
Okay, so we went over Shannon. Let's say again what
let's not. Okay. Let's say what Kaufman says.
Well, no, let me first say what Shannon says. Or let's say what people say Shannon might have said, but didn't. Okay, so Shannon's got the idea that you're passing signals down a wire and you're reducing at the receiver's end uncertainty about the message that is sent. So if you don't know if it's going to be a 1 or a 0 and coming down the wire you get a 1, you, the receiver, say not Shannon, but others talking about Shannon, have less of the uncertainty in your mind about what was sent.
What?
You've lessened the uncertainty in your mind about what was sent. It was a 1, not a 0. So you, the receiver, have gotten information. This is not Shannon. Shannon just measures the amount of information. The standard view of it is, in its most trivial interpretation, you, a human being, receive it and say, oh, it's a 1. But that requires, I think it's essential that it requires an agent to receive the information. And you see, in information theory, there's only syntactics. There's only the pattern of ones and zeros. There's no meaning. Okay, I'm going to give you two definitions of information, and there may be multiple definitions. One coming from Schrodinger about the microcode in the aperiodic crystal that's going to direct the development of the organism is that the microcode is constraints on the release of energy that builds the organism. And therefore, I want to call constraint information, but constraints are boundary conditions, at least in classical physics. I don't know what it is in quantum mechanics. Well, I do, but let's not talk about it. So let's call a primitive sense of information constraints. There's no semantics in that either. There's no meaning. For example, you might have a self-reproducing thing or the constrained release of energy that's doing work, but we don't have meaning yet. For that, we need semiotics. Now, I think we need the Peircean account. And Peirce talks about a sign and an interpreter. And now let's take our bacterium swimming up the glucose gradient. Basically, glucose or a glucose gradient is a sign, more glucose in that direction. You've got to have a receptor that can pick up this gradient, like two receptors on your surface that can pick up a different concentration. And then you gotta interpret it. Well, the bacterium does. It orients towards it and swims in that direction, roughly. Okay, so once that happens, I think you have the rudiments of semantics. The glucose gradient means sugar that away to the bacterium.
When you got to semantics, you included agency.
It includes agency.
Or is, and there's clearly a connection between the information as you're defining it, the semantic,
and agency.
And agency.
Correct. So I think once one, I think that in order to get semantics, I personally think, you need the notion of agency. Remember, there was a cheat in getting agency into the bacterium. We imported teleological language. But this is a Wittgensteinian language game. There's a cycle of appropriate concepts that work at some stage in the evolution of life. And that tough luck. That we just need them.
Well, and the agency, because this agency it seems to me very important, particularly when you address the semantic piece as contrasted to the reductionist view of science. And it seems that the agency, the ability to find some semantic content in whatever process is going on is a minimal requirement for agency, the ability to discern the gradient.
Right.
So, right. I think so. In order to have agency, we have to have some information.
Right. And a way of formalizing what you just said is that we may want to say that you don't have an agency unless it can make at least one choice. Sugar that way or not. Or a more complicated choice, yuck versus yum. Okay?
Yes.
Okay. But yuck or yum or not suffices. So we may want to, and in fact, Philip Clayton and I, in the article that we wrote, imposed that condition, the capacity to make at least one choice.
And that agency and that information is extensible from the bacterium to us.
Mm-hmm.
You mean in terms of evolution or in terms of life forms?
Yes. Both. Right?
Yeah, right.
What is teleological?
Well, so Aristotle defined it. So let's take the simple case. I want to go to the grocery store. I get into my car or my horse or on my mule or take a helicopter and jump out of it and I go to the grocery store. The end for which I act is going to the grocery store. And Kant talks about it. It's means to an end, my car, and ends in themselves, going shopping, although that in turn is means for an end. And then he talks about things that are ends, period. So teleological is that which occurs to get to a state. And in Aristotle, it becomes the final cause in which the acorn strives to become the oak as its goal, okay? And it's worrisome. But we use it all the time in describing human actions under intentions.
Sounds like purpose.
Its root in us is purpose.
There are a number of words that are usually associated with it. I want to hear those words. Meaning, value.
Yeah, right. Well, for human beings, it's meaning, value, purpose, intention. John Searle describes actions as occurring under a description, by which he means the intention. There's something very funny about this, by the way, that we should remark. What does it mean for something to occur under a description? Well, that's the relationship between an intention and the act that's associated with it.
Without the agent, without information, and acknowledging the relationship, purpose doesn't make any sense.
Right.
Which is, I think, central to a lot of what you're writing
about. You want to say that in your words?
Right. So I stretched our normal talk of meaning and agency to the minimum physical thing I thought we could get away with, which is a bacterium, and then down to something simpler, a self-reproducing system that does a work cycle. So it can act, okay, because it's got to be able to do something in the world. And I don't think we'd extend it to rocks. It's definitional. That is to say, can we prove what I just said in the sense that there's an experiment to be done? I don't think so. I think I've given you a definition. And the thing about definitions is that they're fruitless or fruitful. I think it's turning out that this is a fruitful definition. It's leading in all sorts of interesting directions. And time will tell whether or not it gives rise to good stuff. But you know, if Poincaré is right, F is equal to ma is also definitional. F is mass and force are defined in terms of one another. Again, I caution you that lots of physicists say Poincaré was wrong. Okay? I think he was right.
Well, in this context, it seems like, you know, there's the scientific view and there's the language that is the language we normally use, and it's what we've been working with for the last several days. And part of the challenge is to find some overlap to make the language that we routinely use. Mm-hmm. There's a specialized language, then there's a seriously specialized language, which is the mathematics. Mm-hmm. And then somehow or other, we have to find an acceptable meeting point, or we would like to find an acceptable meeting point in these definitions between the world I inhabit, the walk-around world, what I consider the real world, the world I live in, mm-hmm. And the scientific definitions.
Yes.
And that's been historically a real struggle.
Well.
And continues to be.
And will be. In your ordinary walking around business of, you know, going out to dinner, you're not going to run into discussions about the weak force and breaking of a certain symmetry that wasn't expected that the weak force does. And you need really deep group theory mathematics to understand all of that stuff. You know, so science is in many ways an extension of common sense, and then it leads off, as we all know, in ways that are sometimes deeply and profoundly mathematical, as in certain areas of physics and certain areas of finance and so on. And sometimes it's descriptive, as in certain areas of biology. And that's because we're investigating a world that is a lot richer than our ordinary lives.
Can you do a definition of biology and physics?
Sure.
A short one?
Yeah. Physics takes itself to be the... I'm not a physicist, so all physicists forgive me. Physics takes itself to be the study of the foundational principles about time, space, matter, the fundamental forces, the fundamental particles, this is the reductionist view, out of which the universe is really built. That's reductionism, whether it happens to be quarks and gluons and electrons and stuff like that, or strings or whatever. And those who believe in reductionism among the physicists, take it to be the foundational science on whose laws everything else rests. Now, if you talk to people, typically solid-state physicists, who deal with much more complex systems than the high-energy particle physicists do, they deal with things with lots of broken symmetries of the kind that we talked about yesterday, like disordered magnetic materials, they'll tell you that physics is fuzzier in its definition. People like Laughlin, Nobel laureate physicist, will tell you that the laws that we're looking for are organizational laws. And he goes so far as to say, and I don't understand this yet, that the fundamental laws somehow emerge out of the emergent laws. And I gotta learn what Laughlin's thinking. So that's roughly a definition of physics. And they see themselves to be the foundational science. And broadly in Western culture, we see the same thing. I'm not sure that's right. Okay, as I've been trying to discuss in the last few days. Now let's get to biology. Well, we know a living thing when we see it. Okay, worms are alive and rocks aren't. Biology is the study of living things and how they came to be in the universe and in particular on our planet and how they work. Okay, and we all know that, and I guess that does it.
Emergence is a word we've used over and over and over again. What is emergence?
So there's different senses of emergence. They are all in opposition to reductionism, which is the view that we just expressed, that the explanatory errors always point downward to whatever is at the bottom in today's physics, which isn't to say that it's wrong. I'm not laughing at it to say whatever is today. Of course physics changes and finds new things down there to think about. Right now it's strings, or it's Lee Smolin's loop quantum gravity, for example. So emergence is the view that at different levels coming up in complexity from strings or whatever, that something new happens, emerges. And there's two kinds of emergence. One's called ontological emergence and one's called epistemological emergence. So let's take epistemological. Epistemological emergence has to do with what I can know. So epistemological emergence might say, you know what, it's just so complicated that even though I think in principle I can get from quantum mechanics to the behavior of a fluid described by an equation called the Navier-Stokes equation, I can't. I don't know how to do it. It's too complicated. But in principle, I think that I could. Okay. So that's epistemological emergence. Or, as I argued the other day, in principle, we can't get to the evolution of the biosphere from physics. So far, that's epistemological. It's about what we can deduce. Ontological emergence is about the coming into existence of new things in the universe. And examples are things like temperature, emergent when you have enough gas, and having the property that you can measure more of it and measure it more precisely when it's a bigger system, or the goldness and shininess of gold metal, which is held up by many as an example of emergence. And they would point out that from quantum mechanics, you can't get to the shiny color of gold, the shininess and the color of gold. Another is emergence, and all of this is ontological, okay, novel properties. So another is my example of the heart, where we can't get to the organization of processes coming into existence in the biosphere, that is the heart. So these are all ontological emergence.
There is a key piece in this, and I think for those of us who think of ourselves as alive, and that is the relationship between what you characterize as reductionist, and what's generally characterized as reductionist physics, and life, and emergence. Mm-hmm. Because it seems to me that's what this is, a major part of what this is all about. How do you get from the physics of particles to
life?
Life, and then the agency that goes with it.
With real care now, does life itself, let's say for the sake of discussion that Stu Kaufman is right and that a minimal molecular autonomous agent that's reproducing and does a work cycle is alive. I'd maybe put it in a membrane and maybe put a receptor and a few other things, some doodads on it. Suppose that's alive. There's nothing in that that doesn't obey the laws of physics. Okay,
Classical or quantum.
There's no élan vital in that story. There's no purple magic, mystical stuff. There's nothing weird going on. But there is an organization of process. Okay, that is in the self-reproducing thing that does the work cycle that has come to exist in the universe, and I think that's ontologically emergent. And its coming into existence is probably not reducible to physics. It might be on the edge of being reducible to physics. That is, we might be able to predict the coming into... In fact, I tried to do that with my theory of autocatalytic sets. I have tried to give a story of the coming into existence of it. Then I can't say very much about the further coevolution of it to build a biosphere. Right? Now, we just got to be careful about agency. Because I cheated, or I didn't. And it's really important whether it's a cheat or not. When I said, let's extend our notion of human agency to the simplest physical system we can and import our notions of agency and put it on top of my minimum autonomous agent. And then I said, and I'll say again, well, we can't deduce agency from physics, and therefore we can't deduce ought from is. But in one sense, I cheated. I explicitly said, let's just use teleological language down here. Okay, so you can't get to teleological language from language as a fact. And then I'm making the move of saying, but it's definitional that this thing is an autonomous agent, which gets me around having to prove it. And then I make the move, which may be wise or stupid, that's okay. So a word about definitional cycles in science. Science is full of definitional cycles. We talked about F is equal to MA. I'll give you another one. Many people point out that Darwin talks about survival of the fittest, And then fit is, it is criticized, defined in terms of that which survives. Okay? And it's argued, but isn't this a definitional circle? And there is an enormous literature on whether, in that sense, Darwinism is vacuous. But circles, as many philosophers of science have pointed out, of this kind, don't have to be vicious at all. Rather, they are a mutually defining set of concepts. In precisely the idea of a Wittgensteinian language game that you can ask me about in a moment, a mutually defined, interdefining set of concepts that carve up the world in a new way, that once you're in that circle of concepts, you can say and see lots of things, for example, our intentional actions, or Darwinian theory, or classical mechanics derived from Newton, and it turns out to be utterly fruitful, because it spreads a self-consistent conceptual net across the world that captures the truth. Okay? But you may not be able to get from one truth to another. You may not be able to get from a language of teleological action to a language of mere happenings. In fact, I don't think you can.
You had the grace to say you were importing agency from the human presumption that we have it to the bacterium, where it might be a fudge. What makes it less of a fudge is the continuity from bacterium to us. Mm-hmm. And if you can't do that importation, then there has to be a place somewhere in life
where it happens,
where one is and one isn't.
Or we're not. Right.
Violates our basic definition.
Well, no. Spinoza said, gee whiz, free will. We've talked about free will.
Agency, yes.
It's all deterministic, so I don't have free will. So it's an illusion. And then I don't know what Spinoza says.
So we can be alive and not have agency.
Yeah, maybe we're zombies.
Not a particularly appealing view, but logically possible.
Right. And there is underneath this a wonderful discussion about whether or not... See, I need to say something about philosophy very briefly. It was the view... this is the area of philosophy that I know. I don't know European philosophy. I'm trained in Anglo-American philosophy, which utterly sneers at European philosophy under the grounds that nobody who doesn't speak English can possibly think clearly or something like that. Anyway, it was the tradition I grew up in. At the turn of the 20th century... And growing out of the British empiricist tradition, was a drive to find those statements that are least fallible. And here was the move that was made, and it's worth watching for a minute, because it's going to get it to Wittgenstein, and that's worthwhile, okay? Even though it wasn't what we exactly planned to do, so it's okay, Paula. So the idea was the following. Suppose I say there's a chair in the room. I might be wrong. But suppose I say what I am sensing. Well, hard here, something holding me up back there. So I'm reporting what came to be called sense data. A flat now, red there. So these are called sense data statements, or logically atomistic statements.
Which are embodied.
They are statements about my sense experiences. So they're embodied in my experiences. And the idea was I'm less likely to make a mistake about what I experience than I am about what's out there in the world. Then the hope was, and Russell and the early Wittgenstein are the heroes of this, the idea was to construct statements about the world as logical combinations of statements about sense experiences. So the idea was I was going to replace the statement, there's a chair in the room, by some finite string of statements about sense experiences. This is the heart of reductionism. This is reductionism in philosophy. So the statement there is a chair in the room will become equivalent to, and a shorthand for, some complex set of statements about sense data. Well, it turned out that effort failed. And it's easy to begin to see why. Because suppose I'm colorblind. Well, then we get into a bunch of counterfactuals about, well, if I were colorblind, red, green, then I'd blah, blah, blah. And so it turns out that you can't complete the list of statements about sense data that has the property that it stands in one-to-one correspondence with the statement, there's a chair in this room. Okay? And One-to-one correspondence means the higher level statement, there's a chair in the room, is true if and only if the lower level string of statements is true. The lower level statements are necessary and sufficient for the truth of the higher level statement. Well, it failed. And that failure infests all efforts to find a lowest level language that suffices. It's got to be a cousin, and I've never thought about this till now, to Gödel's theorem, where, you know, there are true but unprovable statements given an axiom set. So I'm using the word cousin because I don't know. And very importantly, it leads Wittgenstein 20 years later to come back and say, you know, that whole thing just doesn't work. And so I'm going to give you one example. He says, consider the statement, Stu Kaufman was found guilty of murder, and Superior Court, yada, 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 blah, 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 blah. Now, we all understand.
On a date, in a place, at
yeah,
a time.
Yeah, in a date, what, date, case, time, you know, for the murder of Joe Blow, okay? Now, Wittgenstein's point is that to understand that, we understand a whole bunch of things, like we understand legal responsibility, we understand evidence, we understand legally admissible evidence, we understand guilt, we understand innocent, we understand the existence of law, we understand the passings of law, we understand punishment, and so on. Call that legal language, or a legal language game, Wittgenstein would say. Now try to translate out of it to a set of statements about just ordinary human actions, so you can replace the statement, Kaufman was found guilty, by some predefined set of statements about human actions. You'll find you can't do it. Okay? It's the same thing. You can't reduce from one language to another. Philosophers have given up the idea that there's a basement language. And my bet is that in discovering that we can't reduce biology to physics and this to that, it's because these are different, if you will, Wittgensteinian language games. You can't carry out the translation.
In Paula's inimitable style, what's language?
gosh. You know,
well, there are so many different languages.
I'm asking a specific question. You, in terms of syntax and semantics, which you talked about in terms of information, meaning and essentially data, what I would think of as data, as distinct from the meaning that the data may represent.
Right.
It seems there are some parallels in language that. Well, we're using linguistic terms, semantics and syntax, and it seems that there's some, likely to be some correlation between those two.
You know, I know the depth of the water that you're throwing me into all over the place, and I know quicksand.
Which means I can move on, yay!
Well, but I just wanted to say, in Guys and Dolls, Skye Masterson...
That's a science text, isn't it?
My mother said... Someday somebody is going to come along and ask you to say what language is. And if you try to answer it, you're going to get cider in your ear.
I have a Paula's glossary that I made as I was reading Reinventing the Sacred. And because I had to keep going back, not being a philosopher or a scientist, is it fair, and if it is, please say it yourself, epistemology is knowledge and ontology is being.
Correct.
Would you say it?
Yeah, epistemology is knowledge and ontology is being. Is that what you want to say?
Uh-huh.
Sure. Epistemology is about what we can know. So for Kant, epistemology...
I don't want to know about for Kant. I just want that one sentence.
Yeah, for epistemology is about what we can know and the conditions of knowing. Okay, how do we manage to know and stuff like that? Ontology.
Wait a minute. Okay.
Ontology is about what's real in the universe.
Real?
Yeah.
Doesn't that get you into trouble?
Sure, but it's another language game. In other words, that which is real is that which ontologically exists.
Okay? That would be a circle.
Well, but I mean, you can't avoid circles. I mean, words are defined in terms of words. What else would be they defined in terms of, except pointing ostensive definitions?
And that is one of the constraints of logical definitions.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're going to have logic, then you're stuck with it. If you're not, then you can do something
symbols,
else.
If you're going to use symbols, then you're going to get symbol cycles.
I find myself thinking, you know, you're talking about language games, and I think of James Carr's, who wrote this wonderful book about finite and infinite games, and his view, totally different, historical perspective, academic perspective, life experience, is that you can distinguish between a finite game, which he characterizes as a closed system, mm-hmm. you know, and which would probably be logically consistent mm-hmm. in the terms we're talking about, and an open game that is open-ended. And one of his definitions of that is a game which has no end.
In time.
And a game in which one plays not within the rules, but with the rules.
Fine. Biology does that.
So biology is an infinite game in that sense, and by that definition, which is fairly interesting as opposed to the closed system, which I think is what you're saying reductionist science is.
Can I take that in two pieces and see?
Sure. Only if it's really short, because I want to get someplace that is a definition we need.
Okay, just to caution, the notion of an infinite game is formalizable. Okay, Cars did it. You can play for infinite time and you can fiddle with the rules. And I quickly said biology is that. I'm not persuaded that I was right. I'm not sure that biology is playing with the rules. Biology is becoming and diversifying and emerging. And I don't think that there are some rules sitting around there that anybody stuck down, including a transcendent God, that bounds it. So life is emergent, becoming, diversifying, creating Darwinian pre-adaptations with novel functionalities. That's, if you were going to mathematize it, it's a little bit like Carse's Infinite Games, but I'm not sure we can mathematize it at all.
Well, you and I have been going back and forth on meta rules and emergent rules, and I think in the sense that Carse is talking about this, your distinction is the correct one. That is emergent rules. Now, and then the difference is that he's talking about us as individuals playing with the rules. You're talking about the biosphere.
So I don't want to call them rules.
Right. That's a longer discussion, and we'll probably have to have that next time.
No, but I can give one quick example. Sex evolved. Given sex, we now have Mendelian genetics. Mendelian genetics has become a law. It's Mendel's law.
Right.
My old friend Richard Palmer at Duke asked whether or not the distinction between initial and boundary conditions of Newtonian physics actually makes sense once you get to life. Because there's some funny sense in which Mendelian genetics has become a boundary condition for sexual life.
And it is a manifestly evolved.
It's a manifestly evolved thing.
What is the adjacent possible?
Okay. Let's start where we can define it. Okay. So I have N organic different chemical species in a pot, say 1,000. And I go to my friend Dennis Salahub, who was my boss and is a good quantum chemist, and I say, Dennis, please waste the next 4 years telling me all possible one-step reactions that these 1,000 molecules can undergo. Just please tell me what they are. And he spends some time doing quantum calculations, and he comes back with a list of all of the reactions that can happen and all of the products of the reactions. And I then ask, okay, are any of the products in this system of reactions new with respect to the original N, which I'll call the N, I'll call the actual. The things that you can get to in one reaction step are what I will call the adjacent possible. That's perfectly clear. It's perfectly defined. We might have to put some conditions on the stability of the molecules, like they've got to last for a femtosecond or something like that. That's the adjacent possible. But there's also...
In chemistry.
There's also an adjacent possible for the biosphere and the emergence of swim bladders.
And there's also an adjacent possible for me as a person.
That's right.
You can say that.
Yep. There's also an adjacent possible for us as people in our actions. And there's an adjacent possible for America with the election coming. There's an adjacent possible in the political process. There's an adjacent possible for any business trying to figure out its strategy to make a living. It's there. We know it. We've just never had the name for it. And then we've got the problem, can we prestate it? Above the level of chemistry, at some point, we can't. Why we can't, I don't know yet. And I think it has to do with an inability to state the selective environment, whether it's biological or business, what will count as success. And the other is that I don't think we could say all the relational degrees of freedom.
What is lawless?
I never said lawless. I've said partially lawless. Partially lawless is a process like the emergence of swim bladders in which we cannot... Well, let me be careful. Let me give you a sufficient condition and then we'll look for necessary insufficient. Okay? So a sufficient condition for me is the emergence of swim bladders where we cannot see the adjacent possible cannot be lawful. If what you mean by a law, and let's be really careful, a natural law could be taken, if you're naive, as a prescription. Well, some people actually believe this, who are good physicists. So let me take out the word naive. It could be a prescription that somehow restricts what, say, balls can do in motion. Or it could be taken just as a description of the regularities of a process, which is what Murray Gell-Mann wants to say, and I do too. If a law is a compact description of the regularities of a process, then there is no law for the emergence of swim bladders, because that law has to be available beforehand as well as after. Otherwise, it's a funny law and only comes into existence afterwards. And that's not what we mean either. So since we couldn't say what the adjacent possible was, there's no law that sufficiently describes the emergence of swim bladders. Now, that doesn't mean that laws aren't still being followed, because as I said, nitrogen can't change to hydrogen. Now let's ask something else. And I talk about it in the book. I talk about considering all possible organic molecules you can make with up to 20,000 atoms per molecule. And there's this huge set of possible reactions on a reaction graph. And now put down a very small amount of matter, you know, like a couple million atoms, and let them wander around on this reaction graph. And let quantum mechanics apply. Now, in a normal chemical reaction where A goes to B and B goes to A, the fluctuations damp out at equilibrium. You go to equilibrium and there's little square root N fluctuations and they damp out. I think if we were to watch our matter on this huge reaction graph, underpopulated by mass, my bet is that I think we don't have any idea what matter would do on it. And it may be the case that fluctuations don't damp out. Maybe the molecules go wandering off in some direction on this vast reaction graph in some way that's utterly contingent on what happened in the past. There may be no law to describe the particular motion of these atoms on this graph in the lifetime of this universe.
What is the relationship between the Darwinian process and the laws of which you speak?
Well, it's interesting you use the word process, because Darwin does too. Darwin talks about as a process. So the Darwinian process is that which is giving rise, plus maybe self-organization, if some of us are right, to what unfolds in the biosphere. By the way, physicists aren't dumb about this. They ask, what are we going to say about incredibly rare events? Well, the emergence of a swim bladder is an example of an incredibly rare event.
Until it happens, and then it becomes commonplace.
Then it's common. They're all over the place.
I have two really big questions that for our remaining 10 minutes. So,
have you answered that?
Darwinian and classical?
Well, no. Darwinian, the relationship between Darwin and law. Lawfulness, as you're describing it, because it seems to me that's at the center of everything you're doing.
I'm not persuaded that anything in evolution, in evolution as it occurs, is lawful in Murray Gell-Mann's sense. For example, there are a multiplicity of ways that you can change from one particular, say, morphology to another. And they've been explored. There's lots and lots and lots and lots of genes that you can mutate and get that change, okay? Or you can get that change because you're in a funny environment with some funny salts or ether in it or something like that. These are well studied. So the idea that there is a unique pathway to get from morphology A to morphology B is in general false. Mm-hmm. The other word for morphology is phenotype. So I guess I'd be hesitant to say that any of these were, quotes, laws.
However,
but I don't know what other evolutionary biologists, and again say I'm not one, might totally disagree. But Darwin was careful. He said process, he didn't say law.
But there is a regularity. I mean, part of this is, and that's why I ask about the law, because you're using a very specific constrained definition of the law. Some of us might think that the constraints imposed by the Darwinian process are themselves laws, just by virtue of their constraints, not in the sense that Gaumont is talking about it, but that those setting boundary conditions beyond which you can't go is in some ways, by some definitions, would be a lawful behavior, that is to say, at least not illegal.
Those are three very different statements. In quantum mechanics, I'm going to start at the end. In quantum mechanics, one view of quantum mechanics is, unless it's not allowed, it will happen. Okay, that's your at least not illegal. Okay, all of the possibilities that are allowed will occur. That's also the wave equation of the universe and all possible social systems that we've worried about. I'm uncomfortable saying that Darwin puts constraints. Darwin tells us about a process in which, in some sense, on average, heritable variants that are fitter will tend to survive. But even that's stochastic, and there's a whole theory of the stochastic behaviors of populations with variations in fitness. And sometimes you just die out. There's only three of you, and a rock falls, and you're wiped out. So tough luck. Even though you were fitter, you weren't fitter with respect to rocks hitting you on the head. Okay, so that becomes then a stochastic process.
Is that probability stochastic?
Yeah, that part of it's stochastic and probabilistic, and you can do perfectly good stochastic process about that, but that isn't invading yet the adjacent biological possible. Okay, I don't know everything that the adjacent possible may encompass. I mean, maybe the falling rock is in the adjacent possible too. Well, it was.
So accidents happen.
Well, but the classical physicists would say it's not an accident. We just didn't know.
Right.
You know, and the case in point is I flip a coin, and I don't know whether it'll come up heads or tails. It's entirely deterministic. I just don't know the micro conditions. So the classical physicists would say, ain't no accidents. It's just ignorance.
In the absence of life, the rock isn't going to fall on the living entity.
That's probably right. That ain't no accident.
There's something going on there.
Yeah, that's true.
In the Stuart Kaufman lexicon, what is God?
God is our invented symbol. There is no transcendent God. Of course, science will never disprove that there's a transcendent God outside of, say, space and time, who made everything. I think science renders really unlikely that there's a theistic God who's working miracles, changing hydrogen to nitrogen. That would be in contravention to physics, and no. Okay? So for me, I want to use the symbol God on purpose to mean all of and nothing more than the creativity in the unfolding universe. Now, if you stretch me towards Spinoza's God, and where Spinoza says it's all of nature, the lawful part where the physicist's laws apply, plus this creativity, I'm not unhappy at all. I mean, if it turns out that it's entirely governed by laws that the wheeling galaxies come into existence, they're awesome too. But I'm particularly struck by the creativity in the partially lawless becoming of at least the biosphere on up, if not the abiotic world, because that's where we live our human lives. And therefore, I think I want to use the word God at least to mean that, and the rest of it is Spinoza's God. Spinoza didn't know about this partially lawless. I don't know what he'd have made of it.
What is the morality that one can pull out of the Darwinian perspective? Does Darwin offer us Darwin's ideas about the natural world, offer us a way to be moral?
You know, I think the safest way to answer that, Paula, is the evidence that our morality is partially evolved due to natural selection itself. And I will tell you the experiment that you probably know, but you may not. And I think it's with capuchin monkeys, and I write about it in the book. And it is the following, that there are two capuchin monkeys in two cages facing one another with a board between the two, and a third who can see into both cages. And the experimenter feeds one capuchin monkey luscious stuff and gives the dregs to the second capuchin monkey while the third looks on, being well fed. One day, the experimenter gives the observing capuchin extra food. And what that capuchin does is promptly gives it to the one who got the dregs, doesn't keep it for itself, and it doesn't give it to the one who got the extra food. That's altruistic behavior. It's one of the rudiments of moral behavior. Now let's assume the experiment's okay. How come? Any evolutionary biologist would say, how could that be? The debate in biology is, on the one hand, selection operates only at the level of the individual and what's good for him or her or it. And then the question comes, where did altruism come from? And the theory within that view is kin selection. Okay, I'm willing to help my kin, but not my kith. They only those known to me. And then maybe I make mistakes. The other view, which is coming back into biology, is group selection too. And the idea is that you have competing groups, and if in one group being altruistic helps that group outcompete the group that doesn't have altruistic behavior, then the altruism genes will spread, and so you get altruism. That's the rudiments of morality, and I want to tell you a biological fact. There's a little lump in your brain on the ventromedial cortex, and there's two big views of ethics. One's roughly Kant's view of ethics, which is the categorical imperative, okay? Which says something like, you should never lie. Then there's the utilitarian view, which says, act for the greatest good of the greatest number. Most of us are neither. I do need to give you the example. See, I don't have time. Okay, so most of us are not utilitarians. If you cut out this little lump from the brain, we become pure utilitarians. That tells you that natural selection has cared enough about our morality to evolve a lump in the brain that determines something about your morality. Therefore, what I have confidence in is not Darwin's theory in telling us about what is appropriate and moral or not, but in the process that he describes as having given us the rudiments of our morality. Therefore, social Darwinism is an example of exactly the wrong thing to do with Darwinism, trying to see morality in Darwinism. Rather, let's trust our own evolution over the last 100 million years to partially inform us about our morality.
And while we might run out of tape, what would a new Eden look like?
I think, if I may reflect back on my hostess and friend, about a year ago, I was at a charrette.
Never mind that. Just tell me what a new Eden would look like.
I think it would involve a sense of the sacred, whether we want to call it God or not, a sense of the sacred, which embraces a sense of membership with profound respect for all of life, sentient and non-sentient. They're all, in my God's sense, God's work. How dare we not respect? And I think out of that sense of respect comes a sense of stewardship. Now, we don't know what's going to happen, so it's only to the best of our abilities. To be stewards of all of this creativity around us is to say, it's bigger than me. It's also to say, I'm a member of it. Okay? And in my phrase, it means we are not made in God's image. If God is the creativity in the universe, we too are God. So I think that then leads us to the planet as sacred. Therefore, in stewardship for the planet, I think it leads us to concern about everything that we're concerned about now, global warming, sustaining our one ball in space of a home, because it's sacred, because it's the home of life, and life is sacred. And then I think there's a huge piece more. I think we have to rediscover our entire integrated humanity. This is the consequence of realizing that reason is an insufficient guide to live our life. Therefore, we have to integrate emotions, intuitions. I don't know how to do this. I, too, am a fruit of the same 600 years of Western civilization that we all are.
Stuart Kaufman's ideas are so big that once is not enough. His book is Reinventing the Sacred. And remember, you can listen again to this conversation on our website, paulagordon.com. Bill Russell and I admire Dr. Kaufman's audacity and his commitment to a new Eden. We deeply appreciate all the ways he shares his challenging ideas with the world, especially his generosity in doing so with us. I'm Paula Gordon. I wish you well.